Hello, welcome back to the Masonic Roundtable, a weekly program where Masons from around the world get together to talk about Masonic news and opinions in a friendly and social manner. As a reminder, the thoughts and opinions expressed here are solely the opinions of the participants and do not represent any Grand Lodge statements or positions. Make sure you keep your conversations open for the public and on the level. To interact with us, you can send questions and comments along the chat, which you can find in Facebook. So hello and good evening to Facebook, as well as YouTube, where we'd love to see a super chat from you. So hello and good evening to YouTube land. You know me, my name is John Ruark. I'm a past master of the Patriot Lodge, number 1957, in Fairfax, Virginia. And let's head over to the very next one. And the one I'm talking about is Juan Sepulveda. Good evening, Juan. Wait for it. Let's see if you can unmute yourself, Juan.
Man, I said it so nicely there.
It was beautiful.
Without audio. Good evening, everybody. Juan Sepulveda here from sunny Kissimmee, Florida, and the brother behind thegentlemansbrotherhood.com. It's good to see you, everyone.
Thank you. Good evening. Next up, we have Mike the Intern. Good evening, Mike.
Good evening, Mike the Intern. Hammy is also, or just Mike Hambrecht. Current Senior Warden, Lodge Education Officer for Lakeshore Lodge, number 307 in Madison, Ohio, and also the Senior Steward for Kessel Island Virtual Lodge out of the Grand Lodge of Manitoba. Good evening, everyone.
Huzzah! And last but not least tonight, Jason's taking the night off, so we have the Robert Johnson. It's like the Ohio State, hey, I guess.
How's everybody doing out there? Robert Johnson from Waukegan Lodge 78, past master there, current sitting secretary at Space Novum Lodge 1183 in Libertyville, Illinois, and the host of the Whence Came You podcast. Good to be with you.
Excellent. Good to have you. So, yeah, before we get into tonight's topic, I do want to give a special shout out. If you like how glamorous we look, it's all due to the patrons. So thanks for supporting the show, letting us upgrade some tech, make sure we have lots of server space for many years to come. And if you want to come back behind the scenes, we've had some great discussions on our private Facebook group for our patrons, our knights and squires. You got to be at the squire level or higher, but if you come on over there, you can pick our brains about things in other episodes, ask for some help, some resources. It's been a lot of fun. So we want to see you over there and help support the show. So go on over to patreon.com/themasonicroundtable and chip in a few bucks. Keep this show going for many, many years to come. So tonight's topic, we are going to talk about the Cook Manuscript. If the word manuscript sounds familiar, it's because we've done a couple episodes on the old charges, on the manuscripts, and even the Regis manuscript. And so yet we're going to cover another one. So this is the history section of TMR for this week. What we're going to do is we're going to start a little bit in the background of the history behind these manuscripts, where they came from, what do we know of them, and then go into a little summary of it. As always, we'll have, you know, references along the way, and really hope that you will jump in with your thoughts as you read through it, read along with us. So anyway, as we get started, I'm going to do a little bit of background. So let's talk a little bit about these manuscripts themselves and where they come from. So again, if you want to go kind of to an earlier episode, you want to look at the Regis manuscript. We did a whole episode on the Regis manuscript, and that one was dated about 1390. So these collections are from what we call the old charges. These are old stonemason, like guild structures that have landmarks, that have rules, that have regulations, that have basically how an operative stonemason should act and carry himself when they're apprenticing, when they are, getting work and that kind of thing. So, for anyone who is a Freemason who knows kind of their own Grand Lodge laws and charters, once you know some of these old charges, you'll find that there's a lot of similarity as there. So a lot of these things have carried on since 1390, since the Regis manuscript. While the Regis manuscript in 1390 was very flowery language, very poetry, it really was meant to rhyme. The Cook manuscript took another kind of the old English type writing, but also was a little bit more discrete. So we'll get into what the layout of that is. The reason it's called the Cook Manuscript is because it was actually published for the very first time in 1861. So it was published by R. Spencer in London in 1861, but was edited by a Mr. Matthew Cook, hence the name. So he kind of, since there was no author, so no one signed the bottom, he decided to put his name on it, or at least to say, this is the manuscript I found and edited, and kind of translated it a little bit. And so that's where we found out about this. So it's amazing, right from the get-go, we have this artifact, this relic of Masonic history that had laid low for over 400 years, right? That had been passed through hand to hand, and no one really even knew about its existence until it was actually translated, published, and put out there. And so it does, at the time, you know, about 100 years ago, was in the British Museum, so that way at least there is the copy that does exist there today. We do think that the Cook manuscript was in the hands of Mr. George Payne when he was in his second term as Grand Master in 1720. Because when you look at the general regulations and some of the ones that Anderson included in his own version of the Constitutions, published in 1723, you can see some direct language coming straight out of there, right? There's no coincidence that you can actually see almost cut and paste, in an old-time version of cut and paste, of that text into Anderson's Constitutions. In fact, Anderson himself made very clear use of almost verbatim lines 901 through 960 of the Cook manuscript. So we can see the entire section in addition to just little snippets here and there. So we do know that it was an influence into Anderson's Constitutions. We've talked recently in recent episodes about the Quatuor Coronati research lodge and all of that. In that lodge, actually was able to reprint the Cook facsimile in volume 2 of its Antigrapha in 1890. So they actually published this again. We knew that it had been published before in 1861. They actually shared it with all the Freemasons who were interested in 1890, and included a commentary by George William Speth. Speth had really added a lot more, would you say, bonus features to this Cook manuscript, because he had been looking at it and putting this together to tell this story, as all good, you know, Quater Coronati researchers do. They just don't say here's the evidence and go figure it out. They wanted to tell the story. So what is this manuscript? We do think it's a transcript of yet an older document, but it was written by a operative stonemason at the time. There were several versions of the charges, in fact, many versions of charges to masons at the time, stonemasons at the time. So while we do know about the Regis manuscript and we do know about the Cook manuscript, you know, in the late 1300s, early 1400s, these are just the ones we know about. So there, when you have operative guilds and you're traveling all around, you know, you're going to need to have some sort of bylaws written down and passed around. So these are the ones that survived, but we do believe that they were influenced and they were, you know, learning from each other as they were developing. What you'll find interesting about the Cook manuscript is that it's actually in two parts. The first half is really an attempt at the history of the craft, and as you'll hear Hammy go into detail, it takes a lot of the poetic liberties to paint this beautiful picture of the history of the craft, just like Anderson eventually would do in the Constitutions. And then the second half of the Cook manuscript really talks about the charges, meaning the actual rules and structure of this guild system. So it's kind of both. You have your background, your history, you know, and how you go all the way back to Adam, and then you actually have here's how we're supposed to operate as Masons. So in fact, what you'll hear is we'll have 9 articles, which were apparently legal enforcements at the time. These 9 articles are, you know, legally binding for stonemasons. And they also had 9 points, which were probably not legally binding, but morally binding. Right. And so, again, many of you Freemasons will know those things that are that we take obligations for that you will be directly kicked out of the fraternity for violating, and then some things that you probably shouldn't do, and you probably, you know, we're charged to do because it's the right thing to do, not because of threat of expulsion. Okay, so that's the difference between a legal enforcement and a moral enforcement, for example. They do use terms like congregations of Masons were meeting, but nothing in the terms of what we know as general assemblies or grand lodges or anything like that. So we're getting a taste in this manuscript about congregations of Masons, more than just one guild, for example. And then, let's see, and then really the short summary, if you're familiar with the old newsletter called The Builder, which is printed in the turn of the 1900s, Brother H.L. Haywood put together a little nice summary of this, which we won't go into now, but it's just something that you may want to go back and dig in your archives in the September 1923 edition of The Builder, where he kind of codifies all of this into a history of the Cook manuscript. So with that, setting that up, I'm going to hand it over to Hammy, who will tell us a little bit more about what's in it.
Okay. So I'm reading from the New Encyclopedia of Freemasonry, combined edition, two volumes by A.E. Waite. So this is on the Cook manuscript. It's preserved in the British Museum, additional manuscript 23,198, the second of the old constitutions of charges in point of date is in prose, like the long subsequent series, and is referred to the early portion of the 15th century, or alternatively to the latter portion. The year 1430 has been proposed as an approximate date, and there is one suggestion concerning an early original, though no reason has been given. The original editor, Mr. Matthew Cook, conjectured that it was used in assemblies of Masons as a textbook of the traditional history and laws of the fraternity. And this is at least a sound description of the contents. It opens with the praise of the liberal sciences, especially geometry, out of which came Masonry, instituted no longer by Euclid, but by Jabal, among the children of Lamech. Jabal invented music while the smiths and weavers' crafts originated, respectively, with Tubal Cain and Noama. But Tubal is said to have inscribed all the sciences on two pillars, and thus, at this early period, we find a Masonic document drawing from the secret tradition of Israel through Jewish stories concerning primeval pillars of knowledge are connected usually with the name of Enoch. According to the Cook manuscript, three pillars were found after the flood by Pythagoras and Hermes, who became in this manner the saviors of the ancient wisdom. As might be expected, the Masonic version of the legend diverges at this point from that of the Kabbalah, which knows nothing of genteel philosophers in connection with the pillars of knowledge, as it knows nothing also of the so-called liberal sciences. That which was preserved was the hidden doctrine communicated to Adam before the fall. The text proceeds to the time of Babel, which is still termed Babylon, and this monument of early architecture is referred to Nimrod. It was Abraham in later days who taught Euclid Masonry, but it was Euclid who called it geometry, and he who instructed Egypt. The craft of Masonry was learned by Israel in the land of bondage, and they carried it into Palestine, where David and Solomon favored and protected Masons. There is now a leap over centuries where we hear the charges and ordinances prescribed by Carolus Secundus, King of France, and soon after the story of St. Alban, who first gave a constitution to English Masons and made rules concerning wages. The Regis episode of the of Athelstan is confirmed in respect of the point that this king loved the Masons well, but it is superstitious son, but his superstitious son, unknown to history, who gave them further charges, purchased from his father a patent which enabled them to hold assemblies whenever they chose, and even himself became a Mason. The Alia Ordinato of the previous text is practically identical with that respecting the patent in the Cook manuscript, and concludes its traditional history, seeing that there is no recital concerning the Cator Coronati. Now, I'll say one other thing about this, by the way, that I was discovering as I was first reading this before I read it aloud for you. A lot of the legends that are mentioned in this description here are available in the first copy of Mackey's History of Freemasonry. In the first volume, they are actually chapters 9 through 14, covers the legend of Lamech all the way through the legend of, which one was this last one? Come on. It is the legend of the temple. So it covers those, you know, in those five chapters of the of history of Freemasonry. Way, way, way too much for us to try and go into here.
Why don't you also go to that next paragraph where it actually talks about the rules and charges, and we'll end after that.
Okay. Rules and charges. In the latter portion, which deals more especially with laws and regulations, we learn that those who were instructed by Euclid in Egypt were sons of lords, whom he divided into masters and fellows according to skill and ability. Many regulations cover the same ground as the earlier text, but there are others dealing with breaches of the master's articles and the points of fellows. The punishment of rebels against statutes and the ordering of assemblies under joint supervision, at need by the mayor or and of assemblies under joint supervision, at the need of the mayor or an alderman of the place and the president or master. It will serve no purpose to set out the whole series. I have now dealt at some length with two prototypical texts, and to those which are later considerations of space restrict me within narrow limits.
Right. So A.E. Waite goes on to talk about some of the other charges as well, but that's a good summary of really this long text. And so now I'm going to hand it off to Robert and Juan, who've actually gone through and looked at the text and wanted to kind of put some of their spin on what they read, what jumped out at them, and any of their observations.
Thank you, John. A few things stood out that I really enjoyed. Of course, the old English made it a little bit challenging in certain moments, but it was I like how the structure of it is very purposeful, and you have the capstones or the bookends, as you will, are a direct connection to deity. So at the very beginning, it starts addressing the Lord, and then at the very end, it ends it almost as a prayer, including so mote it be. Not casual, by the way. So just all that structure, I really enjoyed. The fact that it opens up talking about the liberal arts and sciences, which I find them to be such an integral component of our craft, and yet we seem plagued by the rampant ignorance of them.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that
the
up.
Neglect.
Yeah, because
neglect is a better word. Thank you.
Because I keyed on that right away. One, because they put the Sovereign Liberal Arts and Sciences right up front. Like, so it's you don't have to read this long to get to it. And so then I said, well, let me compare back to Regis, because I didn't remember, did we see the Sovereign Liberal Arts and Sciences in Regis? And we did as well. So what does that say? It's like, it's pretty darn important, for one, to have these early charges, to have these as kind of foundational knowledge, as well as, to your point, what have we been doing for the past, you know, 400, 500 years or more, where we kind of let this study and application of those go by the wayside.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the funny part.
Go ahead.
As I say, that's the funny part because, you know, a friend of mine, when I was first joining, you know, he loved the senior deacon's lecture, which is obviously the, you know, the winding stairs and the seven liberal arts and sciences there. He actually put it up that he actually put it out there that this was, you know, a lot of these men who were stonemasons, this was their only point of education. And, you know, for them to get the seven liberal arts and sciences was incredible, you know, when you really think about it. And yet today, we kind of, I mean, in masonry, we stress it in the degree, but in the end, even with our lodge education, we gloss over it. Like it's, you know, because somebody else has to do that. And, you know, and it's just common sense. You should just learn this stuff.
Yeah. Mike, and it's the irony here for me lies in the fact that you addressed it as the access that they had to education, or the first, basically that first encounter they would have with the liberal arts and sciences, would be this Masonic affiliation. But if you think about our education system does not really focus on all of the liberal arts and sciences to the degree where you can, at the end of the education, send someone into the wild, you know, or send someone into the world prepared to deal and not be a victim of malicious rhetoric or people that have perhaps some less than adequate experience with grammar, and people that perhaps have no opportunity to use logic to their advantage and the advantage of their family. But it's true. It's like here, in a sense, we're hearing the echo from our brethren of the past saying, pay attention to this because this is important. We're gonna go through the laws. We're gonna go through what our morality expectations are. We're gonna talk about the history of this, but let's open with this fundamental idea of the seven liberal arts and sciences.
One of the things that stuck out to me is, in part, what you guys were both talking about. It calls out the seven liberal arts and sciences, of course, but it starts off with this conversation about geometry and its importance. In fact, even giving some great, somewhat Latin explanations of what geometry is, eventually saying that it is the measure of the earth, right? And when we're looking at what these people did, you know, if we take this narrative that they're stonemasons first before they become, you know, affluent society, speculative masonry, you know, however we want to, you know, that's a whole nother episode we probably already did. But what's interesting is that what you both said, Juan and Mike, is that when we give the lectures today, it's a call to view these things. It's a call to go study these things. And then we kick their butts out of lodge and we don't ever bring it up again. And what's more is actually, like, we've got the Regis, the Cook, and several of the manuscripts, Alnwick, and all these things that move through time. And at the beginning of just about every single Grand Lodge constitution and bylaws, it has some version of these charges, or ancient charges, or whatever you want to call them, of a manuscript. And then it usually mixes in the landmarks, right? And what I think is interesting is, At every stage or every level, you would have assumed these are written down. It's like a written kind of mythological, super made up story about, you know, where masonry comes from. But what's like apparent is this complete lack of understanding and giving it today. We don't put these things in front of our Masons today. We would never, I don't think you'd be hard pressed to find a lodge out there who brings an entered apprentice into the lodge and then goes down the list, right? And tells them, hey, just so you know, now that you're a Mason, and at this time, right, there's no master Mason, right? It's just you're in or you're out. That every master of this art should be wise and true to the Lord, that he serveth dispensing his goods truly as he would his own were dispensed. You know, go into these rules. We don't give these rules out. Like, we have some things, you know, pertaining to what you should do in an obligation, but most of them have nothing to do with these original foundations that were laid out. I say original, put those in air quotes. And then continuing on with through these different points, you know, 9 articles and 9 points, you know, these rules about how to conduct, right? That he covet not the wife, not the daughter of his masters, neither of his fellows. You know, those should be at least somewhat interesting, and you know, you make those connections with what we do today. But we don't go through a lot of this stuff that was like today. You wouldn't read this at verbatim anyway, because it's like reading the wrong language to a group of dudes who probably can't understand it. Not to say we're dumb, we don't read that way anymore,
right?
But like, imagine if we had given, what if we did put this stuff in front of our brothers, because we don't really give a history like this. What if there was a real updated version of a history that we could run today? And that's what I find really interesting, is the care to which these documents were put together, and then put out there and preserved for brothers for the future, you know, to look back on. Or, you know, who knows? Did they even think that these would ever be looked back on? Like, right. You have to wonder if they ever even gave, you know, a thought to this. So that's what's really interesting, is exactly, you know, what Juan and Mike are pointing out there. There, you could have something as serious as this in Masonry today, but we kind of don't. And most Masons would just say, well, it's all in the charge, or it's all in the lectures that we give. But it isn't, because a lot of this isn't in that stuff. And we don't tell our Masons to go back and read this stuff either. Like, oh, if you feel like it, well, you can go read it.
And that's again, like, that's why Jason, he went and did his whole Noah presentation and starts going down all these like Noah rabbit holes, because it all came from one conversation he had with one brother in Lodge, who's like, you know that like Noah is in Anderson's Constitutions. Jason's like, what does Masonry have to do with Noah? Oh, it's there. Go figure it out. And just, like, mind blown. Pandora's box was open, and Jason has an internationally known presentation on the antediluvian origins of Masonry.
Can we pull that thread a little bit? I mean, so last week on WCY, I did an episode about the manuscripts. And the history that I read was compiled in 1919 or 1916 by Silas H. Shepard. Awesome dude, great writer, yada, yada. And when I was done recording the episode, I'm like, I'm not going to go back and edit this out or redo it or anything, but I do want to be prepared for any whiplash that happens. So who did I reach out to? I reached out to Dan Gardner, who's like probably in my eyes the foremost expert on some of these manuscripts. And I said, is this legit? You know, like the way this guy lays it out? And he goes, yeah, pretty much. And that got me really thinking, because okay, here's Anderson's Constitutions. And then next, it passes through the hands of some dudes who kind of like evangelize it and I don't have a term for this, Christian it up a little bit. And then it moves through the hands to people, to Webb and all. Okay, so Preston, and then to Webb and blah, 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 blah. All the while, it gets like some Christian influence along the way. And here I am thinking of a presentation just I heard a few months ago regarding French Masonry, and how one of the original French Grand Lodges, right, the one that we kind of don't recognize because they don't have a stipulation about the belief in deity. Well, their belief in non-deity says, well, it's because we stripped back what it is all the way back to Anderson's Constitutions, to like where it doesn't mention a supreme being. Like, so what we're practicing is actually more true to Freemasonry than anything. And I'm thinking, is that true? Right? Let me go back and read Anderson's Constitutions again. I don't know how that can be true, because Anderson's Constitutions has several references to the Bible, like the Christian Bible.
Right.
Okay. And then you go, oh man, well, where does Anderson get it from? Oh, you go back to the Cook manuscript, the second oldest manuscript. Well, holy cow, holy S word. It's all in there too, right? Like, it's super biblical. The mythological heritage of Freemasonry is completely riddled with a story that goes back, as John said, to Adam. Okay. And then you're like, well, maybe that's just a Cook manuscript. No. The friggin' Regis manuscript is the same, only, you know, it's in verse. In fact, I think the Regis manuscript has 23 mentions of the word God. So, like, I don't understand it completely, you know, how people can say somebody had only Christianized it after Anderson's Constitutions. But what's striking about just the Cook manuscript alone is the amount of, like, the Cook manuscript itself is a lesson in mythological, I'm saying mythological, I'm not trying to be offensive, but biblical history.
Right.
You know, Old Testament.
And I'm glad you got, because that's where I wanted to jump in too, was I really like, again, if you take the literal aspect out of it, right, do you really truly think that Anderson believed that the original stonemasons came from Adam? No, I don't think he literally believed that. But it makes a great story, right? Don't ever let facts get in the way of a good story. And so that's where I think with Regis and with now with the Cook manuscript, that's exactly what the authors were trying to convey. One, out of a sense of pride, right? We are stonemasons. We have this history. You're like, be proud of this thing. The same way that, you know, nationalism, for example, you're proud of your country that you were born in because it's got a history. You know, it's that same feeling of belonging, of unity, of being part of a club, right? But in addition, the thing that I picked up on was, like, for example, where the three pillars were found in after the flood by Pythagoras and Hermes. So these are two completely different characters, figures, icons, you know, and I'm a big fan of archetypes as well, throughout history, you know, completely unrelated. And so you have Pythagoras and Hermes, both who found these pillars that had some secrets in them. You can't tell me that language was not deliberately drafted in order to evoke some sort of nod to the past, to carry the theme and the mythology into to weave into this story. That's why, again, this is exactly what I'm talking about when I say that Freemasonry is a syncretic system, right? It is not just one story that's changed over time. It's been infused on purpose by these authors to make sure that it's not just, again, it's not just a Bible Club 2.0. It's an actual infusion of different thought processes. Juan?
You said syncretic, and I really thought you were going to say cult. Say that in jest, but seriously,
you're not wrong though.
If you think about, let's not say, because I know people get, you know, their aprons in a bunch whenever you say cult in a phrase related to Freemasonry or religion.
Occult.
Yeah. When you think about many. And I can't say all religions, but many origin stories from religions. The first ones that comes to mind, let's go from today on backwards. Scientology, completely worked by L. Ron Hubbard, yet there he harkens back to all this history that he wants to connect people to.
Gotta and tie it back.
Thereby, yep. Exactly, thereby connecting them. You think of Joseph Smith,
right,
with his tablets. He, you know, this was put back then, but, you know, it was made by whomever and placed there for me to give you the message. And now you have that connection. And you keep on going religion by religion, all of them. Oh, well, many of them, and you have that connection. Now, is that, it's almost like an unwritten rule that groups have to follow in order to drum, you know, beat that drum and get everybody in line to follow the lessons and the dogma that comes along with an organization like that. But let's say that's the case, even with Freemasonry, right? How many people derive an incredible benefit from Scientology? People's lives that may be transformed in
some
the process.
Some do, right. If it makes them a better person, so be it.
Let's let them play with whatever they want to play. But in our case, of course, you'll have people, and even though you said that you doubt that they believe that it arcing back to Adam, I've come across a few Masons in my time that swear to God that
same dude, same bro,
yeah, hey. Right? Anunnaki connection, Egyptians.
I would put it on George Oliver, who wrote The Antiquities of Freemasonry, because it's in there that it harkens all the way back. I wouldn't doubt for a second he believes it.
Born in blood, right? All of those. Exactly. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I thought that was very interesting. It was for me personally, it tends to be a little uncomfortable to like navigate through some of that biblical storytelling in connection to Masonry, because I want to see that separation, like the deep inside of me. I want to see that separation. Freemasonry is one thing, and then you have religion is something else. But I do have to respect and not just respect, I enjoy being able to get rid of that initial gut reaction and then focus on the archetypes like you mentioned before.
Yeah, and so I think, again, that is the result of a modern era, in my opinion, because we have the advantage of, or disadvantage, however you want to look at it, of not being in a theocracy, right? Not having the church be integral to your daily life. And if you are not a believer of this church, then you are basically ostracized by society, not by the church, but by everyone else. Like, people are not going to sell goods to you because you're, you know, a filthy atheist or whatever, right? So, so you have the luxury of looking at, these documents and trying to separate, you know, not church and state, but church and Masonry. And again, we've talked about this. This is how Masonry has evolved into a secular, non-denominational, right? It's not a religion, but it has inherently religious aspects, et cetera, et cetera. And that's the Venn diagram of how we're able to talk about specific theology and philosophy without calling it a cult, a church, or whatever, right? But to your point, a couple hundred years ago, that wasn't the case, that they were one and the same, and that you had to justify, you know, with the good book, that Masonry is aligned to what Noah would have wanted, right? What Moses would have wanted, right? So that's why it's probably even more of the reason why it got a special shout out in the Regis history, in the Cook history, etc. Because if you can't tie it back to that, we're building cathedrals. If we're on a mission from God, right? Like the Blues Brothers. So if we're not here for God, then who are we here for? And so yeah, that's another reason why I think they tied it together like that.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, with me, it's.
Go ahead, Hammy.
Say with me, it's, you know, I understand, you know, like when Juan said he, you know, would like to see that separated. But, you know, I know it sounds funny because I'm not, you know, very religious myself. I have belief, but I'm not very religious. But when I take part in these degrees that tie to almost a living story from the Bible, I mean, that's what it comes to me is, I mean, even, you know, it's a living story with me. That's when I connect to it in such a much stronger way than I ever did. Even honestly, going to church. I mean, it just, and it's, you know, I heard these stories there, but to do it in these degrees and the orders, you know, like when I got into commandery for the Christianity side of things, it became alive. And that connection to me was almost as powerful as picking up a fiction book about World War II, and one of the actual characters is George S. Patton. You know, it's like somebody's writing fiction, but they're using the real people, and it just made it such a real connection that way, you know. And so even with this, that's the same principle. I mean, I know it's almost silly to tie it to that fiction, but that's what it, you know, what it does for me, you know. So.
Robert, you were going to say?
Yeah, so it's almost as if maybe you've got a brand. Okay, this is a really, I'm a king of stupid examples. Okay, got my first tattoo when I was 18 years old. I came home and I showed my mom and she was pissed. And I was like, but look, it's your birth year in another language. Right? I appeased her.
She was even more mad.
I appeased my mom. It was an honor to my mom. Even though the thing that I got, you know, was for me, you know? Okay, so translate that to masonry. Could you make an argument that masonry has connected itself in this way to biblical origins to appease the authority of the day? Like, I wonder about that sometimes. Because we do see in history, for instance, the person who taught Aquinas, he was amazing, but at the same time, what he thought, what he was teaching, things like Greek type virtues and Greek teachings about God, nobody was allowed to do that, but he could do that. Because he was true. Like, nobody was allowed to, you know, talk about what entails church dogma unless right. You're Tom Aquinas.
Yeah, what was heretical before then. Mm-hmm.
That's right. So then I wonder, like, because masonry has perhaps its roots, right? It is an amalgamation. Its ritual is at least an amalgamation of nothing more than ritual appropriation from several cultures, whether that be Egyptian or Greek or whatever. So because it has those kinds of teachings, and I realize, like, we're talking about Cook manuscript era where there's probably not a whole lot of ritual. Like, Jason covers this wonderfully, but like these plays that happened, most of which are biblical in nature, I don't know. Connect the dots. I mean, is it reasonable to suppose that we could say there was a religious context associated with masonry in whatever degree to make it more appealing to the authority of the day?
I mean, I love that thought, especially because I see what I perceive as evidence in the way that masonry is practiced in other countries. I have in my possession some degree work that is not as charged with Christianity or by, let's say, the Judeo-Christian tradition as we are. So, and I even see how it could be perceived as heretic by some to, you know, for it to have that kind of flavor. But, you know, like I mentioned earlier, like for me, it's initially that reaction that I get for, oh, you know, this may be a stretch for you to claim that there's this connection. But whether there's a connection or not, it doesn't matter. Like, this is when we're watching the Marvel Cinematic Universe, we're not constantly criticizing whether, oh, that's impossible. They could not have done that. He could not have picked that up, or there's no way that would have happened because of this or the other. No, we are engrossed in that story and we're deriving some sort of benefit from being exposed to that storyline. In our case, we're able to have this morality play and we are able to have these stories that share those profound archetypal lessons, and you can see yourself in them. Sometimes you can see yourself in it literally as you partake in the degrees. So there is great benefit from perhaps shaking off that icky feeling that this is impossible. It's like, dude, it's a movie. Watch the movie. Just get the benefit from the movie and shut up. You know, pass me the popcorn.
So, I think one thing too, again, that we kind of didn't go in a deep dive on, because this was a great conversation that just started going crazy, which is again the beauty of just nerding out with your brothers on this, is we didn't go into detail what those 9 points were either, as far as the charges as they go. And so I did want to kind of summarize some of those. And so I'll kind of cut over to a screen here so you can actually see some of these, follow along at home. But first, so out of 9 principles, points, let's kind of go briefly into what those are. And again, they'll sound familiar if you're a Freemason today. First, principally, to love God and the Holy Church and all the saints, and his master and fellows as his own brothers. Second point, you must give a fair day's work for his pay. Remember, this is an operative Masonry thing. Third point, shall keep the secret of the council of his fellows in lodge and in chamber and wherever Masons meet. Right, keep secrets. Fourth point, that he shall be no traitor to the art and do it no harm. Right, so you basically don't want to give away you don't want to spoil Masonry, for example. Fifth point, when he receives his pay, he shall take it without murmuring and shall be arranged at the time by the master. So you basically get your wages paid and be happy with that. Sixth point, In the case of disagreement between him and his fellows, he shall unquestionably obey the master and be silent about it at the bidding of his master. Okay, so it's showing authority of the master, and it's showing about the decision-making that goes into the master. Seventh point, this one's interesting. He shall not covet the wife or the daughter of his master or of his fellows, unless it's in marriage, nor shall he hold concubines, on account of the discord this might create among them. Interesting. We got to write it down. That means if there was a law made, someone broke it in the past. So, eighth point. Should it happen that he becomes his master's warden, then he shall be a true mediator between his master and his fellows, and he shall be busy in his master's absence to the honor of his master and the profit of the Lord who employs him. Very similar, even today in Masonic lodges. If the master's away, the wardens can rule and govern in his absence. So that's where this comes from. All the way back, to the 1410-ish. And then finally, the ninth point. If he is more capable and skillful than his fellow working with him in the lodge or in any other place, and he sees that because of lack of skill his fellow is about to spoil the stone, and he can teach him how to improve the stone, he shall instruct and help him, so that love may increase among them and so that the work of the employer is not lost, right? This is no different than whispering good counsel into your brother's ear. Amazing to see these operative lessons and charges and structure carry forward, hundreds of years later. So that brings us now to our final question of the night. And so the final question to go around will be, what's your biggest takeaway? What is the biggest takeaway that you want to share or you've learned about the Cook Manuscript? So let's start with Mike the Intern.
My biggest takeaway is that we should mention that Lamech was a Mason and not George Washington.
Now, I was going to ask. I didn't see anything about George Washington in the old charges. It's amazing. I don't believe that there was Masonry before that.
That's right. But no, actually, it's more about the 7 liberal arts and sciences, because, that's one I actually, very much like. I've actually started teaching some lessons on grammar and rhetoric in Lodge, because it's, something I feel very strongly about, especially grammar. I mean, yeah, I do want to cover rhetoric and logic, but sometimes that, those lessons can even elude the best of brothers. So. But grammar, we can all benefit from that on a regular basis. And, you know, that one, you know, that's, but in any case, coming out of this, it's those 7 liberal arts and sciences, getting those to be a focus of lodge education, I think is something I'm taking away from it. So.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you. Let's head over to Robert. What's your biggest takeaway from the Cook manuscript?
That we really have stuck to the narrative over, you know, more than 200 years. The Cook manuscript is supposed to be 1450s, circa. I mean, the narrative that we've been pushing for a very long time, you know, even if it was at this point meant to be considered literal. Today we have this wonderful thing, you know, libraries and research, and we're super smart that we think we are. And we can look back and we can see where we've come from. And we have this, I mean, it's a beautiful thing to be able to look back at the history and compare and contrast and not really, you know, judge our past brothers for what they wrote, but to understand it in the context of today. And we really see this as, archetypal use. You know, every day men join the craft who are not Christian, who submit themselves to an ordeal that is inherently has a foundation in Christian lore and in Jewish lore. So it becomes like inevitable to understand this narrative through an individual, like to understand your individual experience through an archetypal narrative. You know, maybe there's a CIA guy out there who's like the boss at killing dudes, right? And maybe you are watching Pinocchio and you're learning a lesson, imagining yourself as Pinocchio. Or maybe you're Pinocchio and you're watching John Wick and you can see yourself in the story. However that happens, right? Like, it's just a formula that seems to work. It seems to resonate. And we've been sticking with it for a long time. And I think that's really what's incredible for me was because I didn't just read the Cook manuscript before the show. I read the Cook manuscript and then I went back and I read the Regis poem. And I was just like, you know, this is just really incredible. And then I compared it to my own Grand Lodge constitution and bylaws and a couple other states. And I thought, this is just amazing to me that we have really taken that story and run with it. And it seems to be a winning thing to do, right? When we have been around this long. So I hope everybody out there, this week enjoyed this episode. You know, it wasn't like some typical boring historical debate on the Cook manuscript. You know, I think we had a lot of fun talking about the ins and outs of this thing and the similarities to other organizations and manuscripts that exist. I hope we do another, you know, manuscript episode. Maybe the Knights and Squires can pick like a really obscure one that's different. And we can chop that thing up and see what's up. But yeah, that's all I got. So if you like Masonic Podcast, check out Whence Came You, Sundays 9:30 every week. Thanks.
Thank you, Robert. Okay, headed over to Juan. What's your biggest takeaway?
For me, the biggest takeaway was, of course, I found a lot of interesting things while preparing for the show. But when I listened to RJ ask, I wonder if these people wrote these manuscripts with the knowledge that maybe someone in the future would read it. And that sent me down a thought rabbit hole, because it made me think of a lot of people that I admire, people that are science educators, people that are philosophers, that they don't only present the information and they don't only lecture to people the truth and things that are important. They do so in a manner that is going to be so impressive upon the recipient that it has the potential of becoming a sound bite for the future, or it has the potential of being part of the highlight reel of education for the future. And of course, the biggest example that I can share with you is Carl Sagan. This is a man who had a profound influence in science education, and he was teaching some things that were similar to many other men in the time at the time, but the care and the poetry and the passion that he put behind that delivery was worthy of us now in YouTube checking out clips of him telling something or giving an anecdote or an allegory about some lesson. So I say all this to encourage you, brothers, to think in these terms. You have men of impressionable minds in your midst. Whenever you have someone knock at the door of your lodge and request admission, they are fertile ground for these seeds of inspiration, these seeds of knowledge that have the potential of bearing fruit later on in their Masonic career. See how can you craft the message in a way that it's going to not just deliver the goods, but it's going to deliver it in a way that it's going to last that man a lifetime. The experience of the degree to be done with such perfection, such nicety, that it is cemented in the life and in the mind of this individual. They only get one chance to go through the degrees. They only live this one life, or so, as far as evidence go, and it's in your hands to really have an impact in them. So I encourage you to do it. Another thing, talk about this manuscript and the Regis poem and duality and all those kinds of things once you go back to lodge, so that we can then follow what is recommended in this manuscript, that we actually prioritize the education in Masonry. If you like Masonic education, I encourage you to go over to thewindingstairs.com, where you can find the Strong Foundation course is one of the things that we offer and helps you put to practice some of the lessons in Masonry. And later on, we have some exciting news with the Gentleman's Brotherhood, but more on that on the next episode.
Nice. Okay, excellent. So let's see, biggest takeaway for me is these manuscripts are fascinating to follow and to follow thematically over time, because when you look at the context and what they were written, and you look at the point in history of which they were written, and then you look at the language, again, you have to really deconstruct it from a fully academic perspective, right? You can't just take the literal words. You can't just take the literal landmarks. You have to really chop this up and understand what they're trying to say. What allegories is it trying to present? What history is it trying to present? Remember, because that's, again, may or may not be literal, but what history is it trying to teach you, so that it can then influence this? And I think, Juan, you inspired me too when you just said, what are those things that these people were writing for future generations? Maybe willingly or unwittingly, that, think about it. I mean, what are you writing today, right? I mean, every man has some sort of legacy they want to leave behind. And so what are you writing today that's going to be read 500 years from now? I mean, I don't know if these guys thought that. We will never know. But here we are talking about it on the internet, which didn't exist back then. So I think that's a fascinating thing, is that it does stand the test of time. It does provide good Masonic research, something that is Masonic related. It is something that you can take and dig deeper into. And I did want to share with you, as I shared the screen earlier, as we did with the other charges, you can go to theoldcharges.com and read all of these. So this is what they have, this chapter 7 in chronological order, the Cook manuscript. And you can read a little summary. You can read the entire translated text and a couple of footnotes and bounce around. So all of these are ready at the ready for you to take into your lodge discussion. So I really hope you take the opportunity to do that. So the biggest takeaway for me is, again, in addition to the charges and the laws, I really liked, again, the allegory that it's trying to say, because I think it's fascinating how they wrote some of the figures and archetypes that make it jump out as there's something a little bit more they're trying to say here. And so I really hope each and one of you unpacks that for yourself and figures out really what's the secrets buried therein. With that, I want to thank you all very much for watching, and I hope you keep searching for more light. Have a good night.
Wow.